egregiously careless pilots. Where do they come from? And what's our responsibility when we see one? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, also the proprietor of Bob Miller Flight Training, a Part 61 operation located at the Lancaster Buffalo Airport in western New York. We get together with Bob on Mondays to talk about safety features because often Bob has a somewhat different slant on these issues than some of the more common voices in general aviation. Bob, thanks for taking the time out today.
My pleasure as always, Paul.
You had in the January edition of Over the Airwaves, you related a story based on an NTSB accident report that I found almost unbelievable. And this was the story of the Mooney pilot who de-iced his airplane by banging on it with a wheel chock. Tell us about this story and what it said to you.
Well, I'm going to quote right from that NTSB report, the lead quote in the article. It said, quote, the pilot borrowed a 2-inch by 6-inch wheel chock from the refueler and started pounding the leading edges of the wings and vertical stabilizer. After finishing the vertical stabilizer, the pilot made a comment that his airplane was now de-iced. Now, this is a pilot that in a Mooney MK-20 had come in carrying ice. He landed to refuel. He had ice on the airplane, obviously. He refueled the airplane, and the fueler made this observation that he was banging the ice off with a steel chock. But even more poignant was the fact that the fueler had to chip the ice away from the wing surface so that he could open the fuel filler cap. So here's an individual came in. Airplane still has a half inch of ice or so across the wing. And he had, according to witnesses, about a half inch of snow on top of the ice, filled up the airplane, got in the airplane, and then took off. And the next thing they heard, just about a half a mile from the runway, the pilot pressed the mic button and said, Mayday, Mayday, 251 Bravo Delta going down. And there was no further communications from the airplane. He had crashed a mile and a half from the runway, and both he and the passenger were killed in the accident. Now, as every private pilot or primary pilot who studies the effect of wing contamination knows, it doesn't take much more than ice or frost, the coarseness of medium grit sandpaper, to destroy the lift qualities of the wing. And here was an individual, and we have to ask ourselves, Paul, was this individual a function or a product of poor instruction? Or was he an individual whose head was in a very dark place and simply took off ignoring the risks? Either way, the outcome was bad.
Well, you know, Bob, I would find it hard to blame instruction for this because nobody would ever let this attitude go by in instruction. I can't think of the most marginal flight instructor I've ever known would never A, recommend or B, allow this to go on in an aircraft just because of basic, you know, self-preservation instincts. I have to think that if this guy landed and refueled and took off again, this may just be one of those awful situations where the thing that eventually got this guy was something he's gotten away with maybe 100 times before.
Well, yes, and sometimes we voluntarily put ourselves in the position of test pilot. Here is an individual who has presumably little experience in icing conditions. He picks up some ice along the way. In fact, it's building up along the leading edge, and he looks out the window and he says, George, I'm still flying. Man, everything they've told me about ice in the wings and contamination must be incorrect because this airplane is still flying. I've got ice on my wings. Look out there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's flying, but he's also descending. He's not developing lift. He's descending. So perhaps, and who knows what the man was thinking, he's coming down, he lands the airplane, he may have an inch or so of ice on the leading edges, on the tail surfaces, and he says, well, the airplane got in here okay with this ice on it, therefore I probably just have to refuel, power up, and I can take off this way. Now, is that naivete? Is that ignorance? Is that the bravado that some of us have that says we're invincible and we're going to go?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the latter. I really do. I think this individual, and it's poor form to try and get inside an individual's head as to what he really was thinking, But there must have been some thought process going through his head saying, you know, I landed with this ice, I must be able to take off with it.
Well, and again, if you get away with something 99 times and it gets you on the 100th time, that means there was a 1% chance it would kill you. And frankly, that's a chance that I don't take if I know about it when I go drive a car or, you know, or walk a ledge or do anything like that. I mean, it's, you know, it's just not worth it.
Well, Paul, you made that point twice, and it bears repeating a third time, and that is, if we've gotten away with something once in an airplane or twice, then we somehow feel we have license or reasonable expectation we're going to get away with it indefinitely. And I'll tell you, as an individual who has flown more boldly in his early years than he flies now, I learned that lesson, fortunately, without major disaster. But I've gotten away with lots of things in an airplane that, thinking about doing those same things again today, I was one of the fortunate ones that had enough good sense to know that that doesn't always work that way. And, so I caution anybody that, has had a good outcome to a harrowing situation, count your blessings because that outcome may not happen the same time, the next time.
Well, Bob, I guess I have to ask about the lineman who noticed the ice, chipped it away, and fueled the plane. What is this guy's responsibility? I mean, legally, I don't think he's responsible, although he could be called into question, I suppose, in a lawsuit down the line. But what is ethically and morally, you know, where do you think is his responsibility in this regard, Bob? I mean,
the NTSB report is, if I remember correctly, this lineman was also a licensed pilot. Now, whether or not he was current and proficient, we do not know. But I asked myself that very question that you're asking, Paul. If I was out on the ramp and I saw an airplane departing or getting ready to depart with that kind of condition on his wings, what would I do? You know, would I walk out in front of his spinning propeller and raise my hands and say, stop, you can't go? You know, would I have thrown a chalk under his tire so he can't move? I don't know, frankly, what, if any, expectation we might have of that that lineman, other than to, you know, emphatically say, you know, I wished you wouldn't go, or you shouldn't go. I don't know. I mean, this is America. We're the home of the free and brave. There's only so many things that we can do to prevent somebody from doing a very stupid trick. I guess, you know, in an unrelated situation, what do we do at a cocktail party when one of our friends is about ready to leave the house drunk? We can grab his keys. That's a little easier than stopping an airplane that's under power. So, good question. I think it's something that if any of us see this kind of behavior taking place, we ought to do our dead level best to slow the guy down and cause him to rethink his decision.
Well, and I have to, if you're going to draw that analogy to a cocktail party, Bob, I have to note that maybe one thing that I would feel really bad if, as a lineman, if I didn't do, was say to the passenger, do you understand how dangerous what you're about to do is? And if it causes a personal problem between you and that pilot, I think I might take that risk.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I would certainly, if somebody saw some contamination on my own airplane for some reason, I didn't see it. You know, it's snowing heavily and I'm already buttoned up inside the airplane and snow is beginning to adhere to my tail surfaces. I certainly would hope that somebody would get on the radio and say, hey, listen, you know, you've got a lot of snow on that tail surface. You want to rethink what you're doing. Absolutely, you know, but here again, I mean, this is America. This is people have a right to. I suppose they have an inherent right to kill themselves, but unfortunately, in aviation, it hurts us all. And I think that's the attitude that we have to take. It hurts us all, and certainly as an operator of a flight school, if we have a fatal accident anywhere within 15 miles of our airport, our flight school hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because it's just another nail in the coffin of how dangerous are these little airplanes. And I think I would have a responsibility to help slow this or prevent this accident if there's any way I possibly could. Would I drive my car out onto the runway and park it in the middle as a way of blocking his takeoff? I don't know if I'd do that. What if he didn't see my car and hit it? You know, who knows what we're going to do in a situation like that. Fortunately, I don't think it comes up all that often where we're in a position to do that. But you certainly raise a good point.
Well, Bob, I'm all for personal responsibility and informed consent. And if you're a pilot, you have no excuse not to know when you're doing something stupid like this. But I think, unfortunately, for a lot of passengers, especially who are used to going out with cars with snow and ice on them all the time and driving them around, Sometimes the informed is lacking from the consent, and I feel especially bad when that happens to someone. When we come back, Bob, you talked about the difference between airworthiness directives and mandatory service bulletins and over the airwaves. I want to take that up when we get back from the break. My guest is Bob Miller. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Wass GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Wass, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Wass GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt talking with Bob Miller, publisher of Over the Airwaves and a flight instructor in the Buffalo, New York area. And Bob, in the January edition of Over the Airwaves, you talked about the what was a few years ago a very controversial airworthiness directive, and that is the problem with the seat tracks on some older Cessna aircraft, where the holes could get worn and allow the seat to move backwards suddenly, often with very tragic results, and often just as rotation was being accomplished off the runway in a takeoff situation. Tell us first of all about the type of accident and what happened exactly technically when these things happened.
Well, what happens is, in this particular case, it was a Cessna, I believe 180 on floats, and he was taking off of a lake. And as witnesses observed, the airplane made a normal run down the lake and then pitched, as he lifted off, pitched up, and the aircraft pitched up to a very steep attitude and then stalled and I guess spun in. And what had happened was the seat tracks, and anybody who's observed seat tracks, they're easy to see on a Cessna type aircraft. They're little pins that are on the bottom of the seat structure that situate themselves down into these holes. And as the holes wear, the pins will no longer grip. And what happens is, as we accelerate down the runway, all of a sudden and without warning, the seat that we're sitting in slides as much as 12 to 14 inches rearward. And now this happens so quickly that we instinctively, our hands are still on the yoke, we instinctively tighten our grip and we're holding that yoke to prevent the seat from going back any further. And of course what happens is we're pulling the yoke back. And pulling the yoke back, the airplane pitches up to its highest, steepest attitude, eventually stalls before we can get under control. And that is a result of worn seat rails. Now, in this particular accident, the airplane had, I believe, had not been in compliance with, for those who have a pencil, Airworthiness Directive 87-20-03, that specifies in these particular aircraft that the seat rails have to be inspected, and that if their size or the dimension of the holes exceed a certain amount, they have to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an airworthiness directive, and we're talking about the difference between service bulletins and ADs, airworthiness directives. Airworthiness directives have to be complied with. They're issued by the FAA. The pilot owner is left without choice. They have to be attended to. Otherwise, there's a violation.
Right.
Now, in this particular case, there was also out there a service bulletin. In fact, it was a mandatory service bulletin, and unlike ADs, service bulletins are issued by the factory.
Mm-hmm.
And when the factory sees something that's amiss in their models, they will issue a service bulletin. And if they think it's particularly compelling, they will issue what they call a mandatory service bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's some debate on this subject, but whether or not mandatory service bulletins are in fact mandatory. They're issued by the manufacturer, not the FAA.
Right.
In any case, this service bulletin directed that there be secondary seat locks, which is a very, very good way of protecting ourselves if the seat rail or the seat begins to slide because of worn seat rails. The secondary seat lock will stop the rearward slide of the seat. Despite the fact that there was a mandatory service bulletin issued that applied to this airplane, they discovered at the accident scene that it had not been, in fact, complied with. And the inferring, of course, that had it been complied with, the seat would not have slid backwards, and the pilot would have survived.
Well, now, Bob, I have to interrupt you here for just a moment and note that this bulletin required compliance within the next 200 hours or 12 months. And this accident happened 4 months and 22 hours after the issuance of that mandatory service bulletin. So technically, this aircraft was not out of compliance. And I guess what that says to me is that we have to look at these things and say, if this thing could kill us, do we really want to wait out to the maximum period allowable before we do it? I mean, there's kind of a separate question there.
Well, that is a separate question. And yes, I mean, what may be legal may not be prudent or safe. And so that I know in our own operation, once we have a service bulletin, I mean, our maintenance people look at it very, very carefully, and where possible, we'll comply immediately. Now, I will say, and any of our informed maintenance personnel that are listening today know that we have a number of service bulletins that have been issued over the years, and frankly, we think they've been written by the company lawyers rather than the company engineers.
Mm-hmm.
To comply with every one of many what would be regarded as inane service bulletins would be extremely costly to the fleet owners. But that's a problem in the system. How do we as owner operators know what our service bulletins that are indeed hazardous or risky or have their potential risk versus those that some company lawyer thought we ought to install just to protect the company, you know, provide a little bit more of a legal defense? And unfortunately, there have been a number of those kinds of service bulletins that have come along the way. The fact that it doesn't carry the force of the FAA's heavy hand because they're not yet ADs, that gives us other reason not to comply. But let's go back to the wisdom of the service bulletin itself. If the service bulletin addresses a safety issue, and under a what-if scenario, something could go wrong, I think every prudent owner-operator would comply with that service bulletin.
Well, and in this case, the secondary seat lock looks like it would have been a pretty cheap thing to do.
They are. They're very inexpensive. We picture some in over the airwaves. They're very simple little devices that prevent that rearward movement of the seat.
Well, Bob, as always, lots to think about when we talk to you on Monday. We appreciate your taking a few moments out for our listeners, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Paul. Talk to you later.
You can find out more about Bob Miller and Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.